Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
So we're recording, yeah, okay.
Yeah, cool, yeah, cheers.
Me. And we're in. Hello, my name is Will Young. Welcome to another episode of Homo Sapiens.
My name is Christopher Sweeney.
That's who you are.
I'm trying to put my finger on it. It's week eight.
That's Nelly.
Can you hear that? A growl.
Weird sound. They haven't been on the podcast for a while.
They haven't, have they?
Welcome back, Nelly.
It's a really fun week we've got this week because we're chatting to the screenwriter Russell T. Davies. How much do you love him?
If you don't know who Russell T. Davies is,
shame on you.
Shame on you, sister.
Who is this guy? He's the man famously responsible for bringing back Doctor Who.
No way. I goddamn, I love that program.
And he wrote Queer as Folk.
What a seminal gay TV show. The first sort of big gay series, if only actually, on, which is slightly worrying considering it was in the late 90s, on TV.
And he wrote recent gay TV shows like Cucumber.
Yes.
He's an exceptionally talented man who has been single-handedly responsible for getting queer voices heard.
I'm just like desperate to be his friend. Everyone should have a Russell T. Davies in their lives because he's like this amazing mixture of experienced, not bitter, fresh, self-deprecating yet confident, kind yet also, you know, able to say some like fun things. And he said one thing that I've never heard anyone else say. God, you're good looking, Will. No, it wasn't that.
Was it when he said you looked like Thelma out of Thelma and Louise?
You know what? Funny enough, I scrapped that from my memory because that was a huge black mark against his name. I fed him the line. Brad Pitt, I said. I paused.
Confession, I'm not sure I've seen Thelma and Louise.
If I had my lighter on me, I would drop it on the floor. You know what really annoys me is when people say, oh my God, what, you haven't seen Thelma and Louise?
Yeah.
They kind of shame you for not seeing
just
a film.
Yeah, exactly. You're like, I just told you that. It's so weird. And also, how many times in your life have you pretended to have seen something or read something? I just think it's really boring to do that. Just say.
Oh, yeah. Proust, whatever it's called. You know, I think I said Nietzsche for about 15 years before realising it was Nietzsche. And right. Even then I thought it was a car make. Honestly.
Got myself a new Nissan Nietzsche. Sorry, yeah. A little bit of windy pops there because there's something different about this week, isn't there, Will?
What's happened now?
We're having a little drink.
Oh, okay.
I just want to point out that it's 5 o'clock somewhere.
We're past the yard arm, as they say. Yeah. We're having a pint from across the road.
I've stolen it.
You've stolen it. Did you say you were going to...
No, I went in.
I've got so many glasses from there.
Have you?
Yeah.
So there's a pub across the road from Will's house. I went
really
in.
Really lovely.
There was a couple meeting for a date at the bar when I arrived.
No way.
Yeah.
No way.
Two guys. And they... You know,
two
when it's,
guys?
Yeah, and it's so... You know, and it's so awkward. And I basically leant round and just stared. I was like, I have to hear this conversation.
I've been on a lot of dates in that pub.
Have you?
Not a lot, actually.
It's close to home.
Not for that reason.
Yeah, hang on. This could go either way.
No, I do worry about that because I think, God, when I say like, bye, and I have to walk further down the street than is where my house is.
But so is it a good date pub then?
I think it's a good date pub because there's the option of food. It's not sort of too romantic. It's not too hip. It's quite relaxed.
Very true.
I think pubs are... Well, hey, okay. Let's throw it out to the listeners.
Oh.
Where are your go-to places for dates?
For a first date. You said something great once, which you said you think all first dates should be an M&S. Because you go for a little shop, you've got something to do. You did say that.
Oh my God, that's so awful.
Because then you've got something to do and you go around, you can talk about what you need to get and...
You know what? I think you're right. And actually my brother said, don't hump the leg, Esme.
Why did he say that?
No, yes. I got confused. I thought it was the table. Do something on a date. Because he was like, who just sits opposite each other?
It's like an interview.
It's like an interview. I hate dates, Chris. I've gone off Tinder.
Have you? Why?
The majority of my boyfriends I haven't met online. I've only met one of my boyfriends online.
Yes.
And I just feel like I just want to meet someone normally. Normally, I mean like, I don't mean normally. He said the word normal. What is normal? Yeah. I just want to meet someone just in a more relaxed way.
The annoying thing about it is Tinder and those apps, when you're on them, you feel like there's a very small amount of distance between you and the perfect person.
Oh my God,
whereas
yes.
Actually there isn't.
Yes.
It's the same as you were 10 minutes ago before you picked up the app. I do my sister's Tinder for her a lot, and we've got different taste in men, let's say. She's always like, the Swiss banker's got back to me. I'm like, yeah, he seemed lovely.
Perfect.
She doesn't like Swiss bankers.
Swiss bankers?
She likes artists.
No, they're cray-cray.
Yeah, exactly.
That's so interesting about Tinder and the other apps are available. Mm. That, yes, the opportunities or the thing, the distance between myself and the perfect person seems far less because there's so many in a kind of confined space. Also, I don't get to know someone primarily on looks. I might not even fancy them to begin with.
Mm.
I'll fancy them more or not as I talk to them. That's the key thing. Once I start talking to them, I would say most of the time, I'm like, I don't think we're right.
Interesting. My experience... Nelly Monster is now growling at me. My experience of that. So, there's this thing about love at first sight, right? Psychotherapists would say... love at first sight is entirely projection. So you're projecting onto that person the thing you want them to be. But I had love at first sight with my husband, William.
Oh, did you?
I really did. And he did look like a Swiss banker. So maybe there was some projecting there. Maybe it was projecting, but I literally had, this is how it went. You know, when something just happens and I looked over and I saw him and my brain went, oh, he's the one.
No.
It was so weird.
You'd heard a lot about him, but you'd never met him.
No, and I'd seen pictures of him, so I knew I thought he was handsome. I'd stalked him online, and I looked at him, and yeah, that and it was like a ping, a voice went in my head, went, that's it. And then so I was like, right, let's go do this.
I see.
He wasn't interested in me.
No, that whole story I love.
But was I projecting?
See, as someone who would be labelled a love addict,
not by me,
can be, what I would notice is that initial rush of like, oh my God, here we go, oh, there is a rush, there is a serious connection between us, would actually be, it actually means now, as I've realized, the person is completely wrong for me. That's because there's... Now, I'm not saying that about you, William, by the way. Because
it's not nice to hear the vicar saying from your own wedding, say that you think the whole thing's...
Hey, listen,
defunct.
I was getting paid, I'll do whatever. For me, it's an adrenaline rush. You know, I still laugh, and I know we laugh, because I'll be like, oh, I'll be marrying him. You know, no.
Yeah, I
think when I really meet someone and it comes from a very centered place, not a kind of heightened... Because there would always be the relationships where I just have amazing sex and loads of arguments, you know? And that's not cool. So it took me about 3 years to reprogram my body and nervous system and mind that connection is not the right connection. And it's so difficult for me now when I see other people because I hear them say, we just have this fizz. And as soon as I hear the word fizz, I'm like, I'm just not sure about fizz.
It's really interesting you say that because this is not to do with love, but I was talking to a therapist and she said, how do you know when something is actually a bad idea that you think is a good idea? And I said, the weirdest thing is I know when something is actually going to end up being a bad decision when I feel in the moment so emphatically that it's the right decision.
Oh my God, yes.
Because it's coming off a fizz and adrenaline rather than it being a measured decision. And so if I call you up, as we do exchange ideas a lot, and it's like, oh my God, I've decided I'm going to sell my house and I'm going to get a hot air balloon. You can travel anywhere in it, you know, and you just go on this big sort of thing and you're a bit high off the idea. That is when I have to go, we've been here before. That is not right. And it should just be a much more like, yeah, let's do it.
Try decision. My God. I have to say, I think that is an amazing place to get to notice that. And because for me, exactly the same. If I'm like, and you know I can get it, I must ring you up loads of times and go, oh my God, I found this place. Oh my God, I met, you know, it could be met this person. It is met this person. Or, oh my God, this song. You know, if something's right, it's easy. It's easy. And for people that are used to working off adrenaline, it seems boring.
Yes.
It's like, no, this is boring.
Yeah.
And like this podcast, I mean, we just sort of came up with the idea and then we did it. There hasn't really been any like adrenaline kind of, you know, apart from the potential of a brush with Eamon and Ruth on this morning, but then that went away.
Did they talk about us going on this morning?
No, I just made that up.
Oh, I was going to say, that would be
amazing. But wouldn't that be amazing?
Wouldn't it be amazing?
Oh, should we get on with it? Eamon and Ruth, if you're listening, and it has to be Eamon and Ruth for me. I just think they're cozy, but you could also get shit-faced with them.
They're like other people's parents.
Though. Yeah, yeah. You'd go around for a barbecue, but you just know that Eamon would end up getting pissed and naked and jumping in the pool.
Yeah.
Or a pond. Or a puddle.
We are really honoured to be asked to go to the London Podcast Festival Saturday, the 16th of September. We've been around for about 6 English minutes when it comes to podcasts.
Yeah.
My dad wrote a porno there. Amazing people are there. And they've asked us to come along.
Yeah.
Very flattered. Please head to kingsplace.co.uk/homosapiens to buy a ticket. And we would love to see you there. Please come say hi. www.kingsplace.co.uk/homosapiens. Our conversation with Russell T Davies is coming up, people. Russell is a hugely inspiring person. And on the topic of that, we wanted to ask Twitter, who is your most inspirational person?
Yes.
So off we headed to the land of Twitter.
Well, I see a GIF. And now I know what a GIF is.
Thank
you. And I know who that is, even from the silhouette.
Paul Madden says George Michael.
It's... Oh, that's not George Michael, is it? I thought it was David Bowie. Isn't that David Bowie?
Can I make a confession? I wasn't, the music-wise, the biggest fan of George Michael.
Well, I think... I think that's absolutely fine. I mean...
Why are you crying, then?
I'm not... Yeah. I'm not a massive fan of the Pet Shop Boys.
No, I'm not
Of either. Their music.
No.
Them, lovely.
George Michael, amazing person who did incredible things. But I just never really connected with his music, and I've always find it strange when you can't hear something that other people can hear.
I had that with Bob Dylan for years.
Did you?
Yeah, and then suddenly got it.
Really?
But I think that's what's great about music. You know, just because sometimes it annoys me if people are like, oh, you're gay, so you must like Dolly Parton. I'm like, well...
Do love Dolly.
Well, me too. Actually, I don't.
Really?
Sorry. Well, no, not massively.
I Will Always Love You.
Well, that's sweet, but we need to get back on topic, Chris. I think... Yeah, but I like the Whitney version. You know, but...
Oh, yeah.
I don't like the Sound of Music. I don't like
I've
any...
I've never seen the Sound of Music.
It's shit.
Is it?
Yeah. Don't even get me started on the Lederhosen. Also, I don't like phone parties. I don't like listening to Sugar Babes remixes. I don't like Kylie Minogue remixes. I know I've said it. So I forgive you the George Michael thing, because I think, well, if you don't like it, you don't like it.
Anne Deal has been in touch, and she says Venus Williams has always been a big inspiration. How much do you love Venus Williams? I love her.
I freaking love her. And her sister.
Yeah.
Did you watch that documentary when they got booed? I mean, how racist in their hometown, the racism that they got when they were performing at, it wasn't one of the biggest tennis tournaments, and they wouldn't go back there for years.
Really?
What they've been through, and then people body shaming, particularly Serena Williams.
Her
body is incredible.
Claire Martin has said, my parents and Matt and Luke Goss, strong and inspirational people with genuine kind nature.
Matt and Luke Goss, I mean, they knew how to double denim. didn't they?
Didn't they, John?
Absolutely great. Did they have piercings in their ears as well, I remember? Am I sounding like my father?
My sister was so obsessed with Bros. I had to sit outside. Sorry, no, this is New Kids on the Block. My sister was so obsessed with New Kids on the Block, so we had to go and wait outside New Kids on the Block hotel for a whole day waiting for them to come out while she just cried on spontaneously on and off, and I read the whole of James and the Giant Peach.
Oh my god, like, can you see I'm literally speechless. I can't why did you go with her?
Because
that's really sweet.
My mum, it was me and my mum, and her mum drove us, so I had to go in
all day.
We all day outside.
Okay, can I just tell you what? I'm going to tell you something now. She never has anything over you and your mum, as in, like, if she wants to do regressive therapy and say, you stole my handkerchief when you were four. No, you sat outside a hotel. Time now for our conversation with Russell T. Davis.
We really want to speak to him. We wrote him a letter.
Yes.
And he wrote us the sweetest email back going, I'm so thrilled that you've got in touch. Because he's a big deal. I thought, oh God, he might be a bit scary. And when we got that email, I was like, God, what a lovely man.
I remember, I think it was Ian McKinnon that said, but I stole the quote for myself. We rest on the shoulders of giants, talking about LGBT people in the past who have been so progressive and essential to the development of LGBT people in the UK and around the world. And Russell is undoubtedly one of those people.
Russell has written some of the best UK dramas ever, including the groundbreaking Queer as Folk. And we started by asking him how Queer as Folk came about.
It kind of came from what I'd been doing anyway, because I'd spent years working on soap operas and 9 o'clock dramas at Granada. And whatever I was working on, I kept on putting gay characters into it, just naturally. No, I wasn't sitting there with a placard going, I must do this, but because that's what I do. If there was a son in a family, I'm the one who'd pipe at the table, pipe up and say, oh, we could be gay. It's for coming out. And I did that. There was a female vicar in something that I worked on, a soap opera called Revelations, and I said, well, she could be gay, and did a great big coming out story with her. Just natural. It's not campaigning. It's just how I write and what I write well. So that was becoming a body of work, and you're forging other people's opinions of you. So I was becoming the guy you go to for that story, and then Queer as Folk was the ultimate expression of what I'd just been building up to.
And someone said to you should do it, right?
Yes. I did a series at the Grand, Granada called The Grand, just like Downton Abbey and Hotel. It's a vastly more unpopular. That was a sinking
always thing.
I love that show. I had such a nice time on that show. And I did an episode of that was very gay. It was purely about one man coming out, played by Paul Warren, Clive the barman, coming out in 1920. It was really nice to go and research and find out what that was like. And the vocabulary, he had no vocabulary. There was no such vocabulary. And I literally found myself writing better than I'd ever written before. It's as simple as that. Yeah. It was a great script. If I say so myself, I could feel myself playing. I'm staring at the subject. I could feel it get better and in my hands, in my fingers as I was typing. It was good. So that's what led to it in the end then. So it was Channel 4, and it was a brilliant woman called Katrina McKenzie, who I knew would be my script editor. And so they said, we'd want you to write something again. They don't just give you a platter of money. It was slightly phrased like, if you'd like to write something again, we'd love to read it. Because that's how you approach these things. But it was the best thing in the world, which was the most frightening thing in the world, which is a clean slate, a blank slate. And I spent a long time, months, I think, sitting there thinking, you can't do it. I said that thing. You can't just write about gay life. That's not a story. That's not a drama. That's just real. That's like a documentary. Gay life is, you know. So I thought, this should be a murder. You know, whatever rent boys found floating in the canal, and his family come along, and you meet all the people in the clubs who discover what happened on that. And I think, it's just not me. I just don't write things like that. I've never written crime. And then you think, wow, what if I had a friend of mine at the time who had fallen in love with a woman and married her. I was thinking, that's episode one. They're all his mates trying to stop the wedding. That's been a long time in my head. Stop the wedding. What a load of rubbish. you have to think through the rubbish to discard it. In the end, I just sort of took a deep breath and just thought, it's just about Canal Street. It is just about gay life. Gay life is interesting. I will make it interesting. I will work really hard at this and make these people interesting enough to carry drama, simply living their lives, simply shagging and shopping and their parents and their work and stuff like that, I believe. So it's quite formatless. You can't quite say what genre it belongs to, Queer as Folk, because it's essentially domestic. You don't call it a domestic drama, would you? It doesn't feel domestic. It's bigger than domestic. It's actually quite hard to define. I like that.
It is.
Yeah. What kind of drama is that? It's about life. It's gay. Well, what people say, it's gay. But I kind of had to relax and say, actually, that's enough of a genre.
Did you worry that there might be people in your life that would come up and go, oh, you're writing that about me? Or subconsciously, you're writing characters, do you think?
Oh, I was nicking stuff off everyone. Any story anyone had ever told me is in those episodes. Everything I had ever done. Oh, my goodness, it's all there. I've been all three of those characters. Those three lead characters are one person split into three. Like when you're cocky and sexy, when you're ordinary and a bit shy, when you're young. It's that simple. It's very... I wasn't aware of that at the time. That's the kind of hindsight of analysis, but... Again, that's why it worked. That's a great little device. Tell all three stories. So yes, it's funny. It's like, because I knew someone who was exactly like Stuart. Oh my god, he was sexy and he was horrible. And I quite by chance ended up sitting watching an episode with him, and he despised Stuart with all his heart. And he didn't know that it was based on. I just sat there, and he was rooted up in front of me to sit there. I was dreadful. And that kind of sums up what kind of man he was. In front of me and the director sitting there, what a rubbish, what a dreadful character. Well, I don't believe a word of it. It's you. It's just you. It's like, I've even given people very hard to spot themselves. I've once given people the same name. Like, it's this man's name and the character, and he didn't spot that it was him at all. Because you never spot yourself, actually. No. That's the truth of it. You know, like when you see a photo, and you can't bear it. You're recording your own voice,
I don't know, Thelma and Louise, Brad Pitt. Yeah, people say there's a likeness.
You're very much like Louise. Yeah.
As I drove off the cliff.
Do you think Queer as Folk would have worked if it was down south?
That was one of the longest conversations I had with myself. No one else ever raised this, because when they first asked me to do it, I kind of presumed they'd want it set in London just because it was a bigger gay community, and I just made that up in the end. No one was thinking that, but I needed a smaller gay community, because kind of everyone knows everyone in it. They do bump it. Canal Street, you do. It's people do bump into each other and but anyway, it turns out, why did they even think about that? Because it's what a setting for drama. A single street along a canal full of gay pubs. It's like, I literally think how lucky I was that I was the person who came along and did it, and that someone else would have done it. Because it's screamingly obvious, isn't it, when you look at it? You go,
I didn't think so at the time.
No, it wasn't at the time. It's kind of afterwards. A lot of things that, if they are groundbreaking, tend to be like that. You tend to go, God, that should always have been made. Trouble is, you never work out what those things are in advance. It's only afterwards.
After it came out, did your confidence get boosted? Did it offers?
It absolutely opened doors in terms of work. Absolutely, and that was lovely. And everything I got made after that was partly because of Queer as Folk. So enormously. So it never makes you more confident, does it? I think success makes you less confident because you've got to do it again. I don't think you know that. You never really go, I've done it now, I know what I'm doing. It's like, you just go and do something different, don't you?
I'm just primarily selfish, to be honest. I'm just sort of doing it for my own means.
Yes, well, there is that as well, yes. Yeah. And that's part of the reason for not... Of course, what could run for 10 years, I could have kept on making it, but I had other things I wanted to do. Great, I'm really glad that was successful. Because there was a great freedom, because the next thing I did was, I haven't done the gayest thing at all, was a series called Bob and Rose, which is about a gay man who fell in love with a woman that instantly lost half the gay audience because they were up in arms that a gay man could fall in love with, which I loved. I loved that perversity of like, oh, the gays all love you. I didn't, they fuck off. And, you know, I really, and also that story was true. That story literally happened to a friend of mine. And it's funny because I set out to write, friend of mine, straight, gayest man in the world, fell in love with a woman, they got married, the prejudice he faced with everyone saying, oh, he's having a nervous breakdown, or she's using him for the money, or whatever. And I was like that as well. I completely disbelieved it until I sat down with him and realised it was absolutely true. It was a proper love story. So I sat down to him like that, and that was going to be like, I was so angry, it was going to be like 6 hours about prejudice, about people being stupid and allowing these two people to love them. And then about 10 pages, it had been commissioned, about 10 pages in, I thought, oh, I can't wait to stay. 6 hours about prejudice, because prejudice is stupid. Mm. It's, everyone in this drama is going to have to be stupid if they're going to be prejudiced. So I was stuck with like 6 hours to fill, so I made it funny. I just made it funny, and literally I won Comedy Writer of the Year that way, because it was so funny once you start turning all that sex stuff and everyone's ideas on their head. Mm. It came alive, that show, and it did have serious things to say as well.
What I think is interesting about that is everyone was up in arms. Oh, how can that happen? Gay man fall in love with a woman.
Why? Of anything I've ever written, such toxic letters from an organisation in Britain of gay men.
Really?
Literally. ITV called the police on them.
People talk a lot about the idea of being gender fluid and non-binary, which is actually what that story is, really.
Yes, it is, isn't it? Yes.
It was sort of maybe too early.
Yeah. I see. It was the interesting thing about the show. You couldn't make them 20 years old, the lead characters. You couldn't make them 18, because who cares? They would have been gender fluid at that age. They actually had to be, the characters had to be mid to late 30s, touching on 40, to be set in their ways, in order for their ways to be turned on their head. So that's what made it rather sweet in the end. Nice. But it was a sign already that a younger generation just wouldn't have even worried about that. Slept with a woman.
There was already that.
Even then, yes. Right. So we had a lot of conversations about their age, sort of saying, you can't make this too young, it just wouldn't work. And I'm not sure you could make it now. I think now you'd say, oh, whatever, sleep with anyone. Maybe. There's still plenty of gay men to still be up in arms, I think. These things are their moment, aren't they? Like, it's trans year this year. I was going to some old newspapers the other day, bizarrely. There's a 1985 copy of The Independent, and there's a documentary called QED, Transsexual, The Third Sex. And the billing, quite sarcastically, 1985 says, oh yeah, we're all gender fluid these days. Because it's 1985, that's kind of comment people make now. So it's funny how it's that old saying, Tolstoy said, the revolutions have to keep on happening. And that's very true, I think. The gay ones have to keep on happening. It's like you have to have a son on EastEnders coming out every 5 or 6 years. Because every 5 or 6 years, there's a brand new generation. And sometimes when they say things click, trans stories, this past couple of years, suddenly that's clicked with everyone. Suddenly it made sense in our hearts to go, oh God, of course that's fair. Of course it's of equal rights. Just took us a while to get there.
Do you think you will have to keep doing that forever? Because you said, ultimately, if you're talking about gay men or LGBT people, whatever, there are less of us. Therefore, will you just always have to?
Literally, less of us. I saw it happen when they did that great story in EastEnders with Danny Dyer and his son coming in, Johnny Carter. And to be honest, as someone in his middle age, it was a great episode, and the sun came out, and I'm sitting there slightly rolling my eyes, but I've seen this before, which is not fair. And it was wonderful, and people loved it. And there were kids, especially young 16-year-olds, going, oh my God, that's me. Oh my God, I am Johnny Carter, I'm coming out. And, you know, shame on my cynicism, because that just it was wonderful, and literally will have changed some lives, and never mind, and everyone watching. So it doesn't matter that they've seen that before. It's wrong of me to sit there and roll my eyes. I'm just jealous, really.
When we were at uni, we were talking about you know, how people came out and their stories and blah, blah, blah. And someone was saying, thank God, this is a massive generalisation, by the way, but someone said, thank God for hairdressers, because it means your mum has met at least one gay person. Because when my ex-boyfriend came out, she was like, oh, yeah, like the hairdresser, you know. And it was like the local flamboyant person. By the way, obviously you don't have to be flamboyant to be gay, but it was like, it's almost like a soap, isn't it?
The culture's fascinating. That's what you do. You like arrive in the tribe as a jester, as a joker. So you're those camp people in the 60s and 70s. You're those people in Carry On films or John Inman and How You're Being Served. And they're outliers, really. They're like the first lemmings over the cliff. And they're vital. They introduce a joke, so we're laughing. Then it kind of gets normalised, and that's fine. It's you know, if a better sociologist could break this down to really clear stages, go culturally, gays, you're not doing anything exceptional. It's what every group does.
They're allowed to make us laugh, but not be sexualised.
Yes, exactly. And then the sexualisation.
Julian Clary was a great linchpin for that.
Yes. And I think people, because I think the extraordinary past 5 years or so, it's people like Jake Shears, actually, like, who are camp and sexy. That's quite a brand new, not brand new, but it is, actually. It's like, before that, you weren't really fancying the camp people. And now I think you can, actually. There's some extraordinary people out there.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love.
Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Yeah, and now Ollie Alexander, I'd say, from the last year, seems like the most kind of, he does a video.
Amazing.
And he's nogging boys. He's nogging, I just want my skin to look that youthful.
Shiseido.
Hate him.
he'll age and wither in front of our eyes. Especially in my cellar.
So cold down there.
Shut up. You must be freezing.
When you said you doing Doctor Who is a really interesting choice, you were like really excited about it because that world wasn't a world I knew, and then to do it, that was a world you loved from a kid, right?
Oh, there was no doubt I would do it, absolutely. And but it was very much my Doctor Who. So I kind of went into it. I knew it would be that funny and that daft and that camp in places and that wild. It's like they wanted all the sensibilities I would put into like an ITV 9 o'clock drama into Doctor Who. So that was great. That was like so exciting. Freedom again. Give an artist space. Give someone space. Give them room to massive space and money and money as well. Yeah. That the trust they put into that is with that much budget and that much riding on it.
And I hadn't been on TV.
Oh, 16 years, is it, or something? Yeah, it was dead. It was completely dead. And I always loved it. It's literally one of my earliest memories of life. Is like when I was 3 watching Power of the Daleks and stuff.
Were you not
like
scared?
That. Yes, absolutely. Because I thought if I cock this up, it's dead forever. Literally, we knew that all of us were going to, if we get this wrong, if it doesn't work. And it was very scary because, in a way, like, Doctor Who's just designed to be popular. It's like, if I write something like Cucumber, I'm there to tell my own story as well as I can, and it's nice if that, it's great if that works. If it doesn't work particularly with an audience, I can still go sleep at night because I did my best. I told the story that I want to tell. As it happens, that doesn't chime with everyone, so never mind, move on. But Doctor Who wasn't mine, and it literally I could bring things that I want to say about the world into individual episodes, and the existence of Doctor Who says a lot about the world and about British culture and about British television, but Doctor Who itself has got nothing to say. It's an adventure story in which he travels around, so that's hard, that's very hard work coming into make that, but also brilliant because it means you can make it your own and you've got to stare at it. It's something I've loved for 40 years, but then I had to stare at it and say, what's this about? What makes this work? How can I make this work?
And what was it about?
In the end, it was simply that thing of writing it with, like every other drama on television, the emotional life. It wasn't necessarily the case in the old series. So Billy Piper cast it to death, you know, but cast well. So Billy Piper being full of life and energy. So you felt it. It'd be very sterile science fiction stories. And so you would do, that's sort of brought to it. That was the thing. You've got to feel it's got to have people crying and laughing. Happy days. Hard work.
I would have been terrified.
It was terrifying.
Take an institution on like,
yes.
And not only that, but the kind of
proprietorial voice of the fans.
Yeah.
Did they lynch you at first? Or?
No, I kind of ignored it, and it's funny because I don't go to conventions and stuff like that. I did my job and didn't go on fan sites and stuff. It's surprisingly easy to ignore. People think you live in a world of a digital spy world, and everyone criticizing them. Not if you don't read it. It's actually quite simple to get along with stuff.
Now that's just a great amount of self care. I think so many creative people in general don't have. I mean, I think you're probably one of the only, if not the only person I have ever met who said that about not reading.
Yeah. I think it's the dark days. If you're like 18 and writing scripts now, and you go online and you read about yourself, or 21 or whatever, it's hard. It's tough to write anything anyway.
You wouldn't continue.
You sit there staring like that without people shouting in your ear saying you're rubbish. And they do. They will. It's
they can.
Okay, exactly. And you're drawn to that. It's because they're only saying everything you secretly suspect. It's like we'd be invulnerable to that if we didn't have voices. That's why I don't need it. I don't need to read that online. Because I've got voices going, you're rubbish, in my head all the time. It's like, so I don't need more. I'm fine. And in the end, you are your best critic, your own best critic. Because also secretly, the thing we very rarely talk about is that I've also got a voice saying, you're great. It's like they're kind of not allowed to mention that. It's you're literally not allowed to. But it's there. All of them fighting all at the same time. So who needs Fred Bloggs' voice joining in with that? It's that's a creative life, is to be listening to those voices of your own.
Mm.
Ha!
Yeah.
So there. Online communities.
Take that.
And with that, a baked tart appeared.
Enough for three.
That's literally like a carry-on baked tart.
Bill's just having a baked
tart. It's breast-like.
He's now holding out towards me. But the face that's holding the baked tart is not a face that wants to share. I'm actually fine. I've just had a jammy dodger thing. What else is in there?
I don't know. My wallet.
I'll have a bit of that. Cucumber. How did that come about in terms of... Did someone say to you, do you want to do this? Did you think, what do I
want to
say?
No, I'd wanted to write that for years. And then, like, the moment I finished Queer as Folk, I kind of thought... And it's me getting older, that is, discovering life as a middle-aged gay man. So that story built up for about... How many years have passed? For about 15 years. And all those characters and all the... And I was dying to get back to that one after doing Doctor Who especially, which I loved, you know, I loved him all my heart, but it is all Daleks and Chasers and just to write men and kitchens and sex and nonsense, anger and jealousy and all of that sort of stuff. Just take me back to kitchens and bedrooms and cars and that, I just love all that stuff. So, yeah.
What would you do if someone said to you now... Gay drama now. Would there be one?
Do you know what I've never actually written is that? Yes, I do think about that. I've never written a lovely, lovely love story. I've got things to say about that, and just it's funny. I've done all that sort of stuff. I've done not unrequited love. I love unrequited love. Mm. I live in a constant state of unrequited love. With about 20 things.
Normally, when I walk past Liberty.
I love unrequited love. I think it's quite healthy.
Oh,
keeps you imaginative, and like always hoping for something better. Well, it's always imagining what would make this happen, and like it's not a fantasy world. It's a very creative one. Brilliant. But nonetheless, I love a great love story is a great thing, and I think there aren't enough gay love stories happening. Mm. Like Richard Curtis would write it, you know, something. Mm. I know. It needs a bit more than that. It needs a proper story as well. I bet it'll just turn into an unrequited love story. I'll start out, and then someone will walk in. I go, that's somebody really loves. Because that's life. I'm a little bit too cynical to do the pure love story, but actually that's what Bob and Rose is. That weirdly, I go on a lovely love story with a happy ending, and it had to be with a woman.
Well, it's, you know, because
I tell you what, this song, I work a lot with young gay writers and fellow gay writers and stuff like that, and it's a constant thing with gay writing is I could show you 20 scripts where there's this story about a gay couple. And the mother's like a brilliant character, and there's a sister who's jealous of them, and there's a bit of a chase over here, and he's in debt, so these two. And all of that's interesting, and the gay men in the centre are quite boring.
Why?
Like, it's hard to look at yourself, it's hard to work out who you are, it's hard to represent yourself, it's hard to write full stop, it's hard to write anything full stop, but there's a real lack of a stare. You've really got to stare yourself and all the gay men you know in order to put you down on the page. You've got to risk being unpopular, and you've got to risk plumbing into stuff that you don't like about yourself, and it's hard. I think when someone like Queer as Folk worked, it's because I was staring absolutely at those three boys. And that's what it takes. So any drama works. My current theory about drama is that all dramas are great when the lead characters are cleverer than the writer. Uh-huh. And that's Doctor Who, that's Sherlock. That's great detective dramas like Morse or Fitz in Cracker or Jane Tennyson, Prime Suspect. They're clever. And I don't mean intellectually clever necessarily, but emotionally clever. They lead a bigger life. They make the writer reach to try and pin that down. Because when a writer creates something, if a writer creates a character called Stan, then I write Stan and I understand Stan. I know he had a funny childhood and his mother left, so he's sad, but he's good at drawing and he can tap dance, so I'm absolutely in charge of him. I understand every part of his personality, which means he's a bit more stupid than me, because no one actually really knows himself in the way that I know Stan. So that character is actually limited because I know him, because I've defined everything in him. He's not quite alive. Ones that are alive are beyond. I think Stewart in Queer as Folk was like that, because he was sexy and arrogant, and I'm not sexy and arrogant. I am sexy, but he was slightly beyond me. But that makes you work harder to, you know, try and reach him, you try and touch him. And in the youth of Nathan, there was someone that was beyond me as well. The Doctor's like that. Doctor is automatically clever in the writer. He understands all of science, all of nature, all of history, all of everything. And you've got to sit and write that, and it makes for great script. It's my current theory about writing, really? Which is like, lift the intelligence of everyone. Not, you don't have to make them swats and intellectuals, just the lives they're leading, the fuller emotion. Like, work hard as a writer.
Are you always asking yourself then that question?
The question I'm always asking myself is, what is this about? And I think not enough writers do that. It's that you sit there going, what is this about? It's about this gay man. It's so easy to go off that path, because you'd be sitting there, it's very easy to go, what is this about? Oh, he's got a really funny mother. It's about that. Mm. That's a lovely path to go on. And who can't write dialogue for funny mothers? You know, suddenly it's all flowing out your fingers, going, oh yeah, great dialogue. Not the point. It's about him in the middle. It's about, you've got to keep, this is true of every script. If you're writing bloody Wuthering Heights, you've got to sit there going, it's about Kathleen, it's not about the Moors, it's not about, oh, it's Winslet, it's not, oh, it's a rainy night, it's not about Nellie Dean, it's about these two. And that's great pieces of work, or novels or whatever, great songs, probably just got one idea, part of it. It's like, I always think that
one title, title for a song.
I think the thing that made Adele an international superstar for the rest of time is that song about, you know, where she's wishing him well.
Never mind.
She
does it in a low key to me.
You know,
she should have gone to that note.
She got such a perfect emotion in there that you just go, hello. She stared as an emotion. Stared and nailed it down in words. Never mind. Not, I'm so sad, I'm glad you're happy. It's never mind. Unless you get something perfectly phrased, whether it's a song, whether it's a poem, whether it's a film, bang, it
that's
lives.
Hard.
It's hard. Oh, we spent all that. We're hooray! I hope one day I'll just get two words like that and go bang. I did it there. That's why we quote great lines from things, because they did that. And that's why there's not that many great lines we can quote from anything. It's quite a short list.
Is it raining? I haven't noticed. Best line ever.
That.
Yeah.
The stare. That's why I keep on thinking,
I love
I'm going to write a book one. It's my writing theory of the moment. Just stare at what you're writing. If it's a sitcom, make it, that man's funny, make it funny. It's everything. It's everything you ever write. Stare at the centre of it. Don't do that.
What about now? I don't know if you can talk about things coming up or not.
I'm trying to get something about AIDS in the 80s written that no one has commissioned yet. It's been turned down by everyone. And it's like, not because they don't want gay stories. I think they're kind of like, I think they'd probably rather it had more AIDS in it, actually, because it starts in 1980 before anything stuck, because I think it wanted to tell the story of the whole decade. So that's proving hard to get made, but I'll just keep
going. What's led you to want to do...
In my life, really. I was 18 in 1980. My life kind of fits... You know, I'm just lucky I never got the virus. My life, literally, I left home in 1981. That's when it started. I was 18. That was my college years and stuff like that. But good Lord, I fit the pattern of those people, of those men, and I watched it happen. Friends of mine died. I wasn't at the centre of the Holocaust. I didn't live in London, so I didn't know that many people. But goodness me, you still watched it happening.
And what was that like?
That's partly why I wanted to write about it, because I didn't know any other life, so it seems quite normal. I remember the 90s, when I worked at Granada. It's like, there were a lot of gay men at Granada. It was a great cache of gay men, and there were days when you'd have a mark on your leg, you'd get a mark on your leg, and you'd wait for it to fade. Is that a bruise? or was that the start of a sarcoma? That was a normal conversation. You have to think, hello, am I going to die?
I know people call it the gay disease.
So, I mean, the strangest thing about it is if you were like a right-wing Republican Christian bigot, it's what you'd invent. It's always seems such a manufactured thing. You know, when people go, oh, it's a plague they designed in a factory, which, you know, I don't believe for a second, but it's hard to out-argue that one. It's so targeted, specific, and yes, anyone can get it, but nonetheless, the gay sexual practices make that spot on, put us right in the firing line for it. I think marvellously this made me cautious and might have kind of saved my life, because I think I spent like 5 or 6 years not believing it, all the way through the 80s. I kind of thought, no, not really.
Really?
Which kind of, I think, gave me a kind of caution about the whole gay scene, actually. That I was describing that to an AIDS practitioner recently. I was sort of saying, when I was young, there was a gay sauna in Newport, and that was like the most exciting. My God, can you imagine me like 16, 17, it's a gay sauna in Newport. That was just impossible. And I used to go to Newport sometimes, and I just used to walk past the door, and I'd be thinking, whoa, that's so terrifying. And then Morgan, but I walked past the door. And actually, this Lisa, this AIDS expert, kind of said, do you know that saved your life? Because part of me's always kind of thought, I wish I was the kind of person who'd gone in when I was 16 and done it all. Yeah. You know? And but if she said, no, she said to me, she said, you know, I might have saved your life in the mid-80s, in the 80s, yeah. Like that, because actually, people did go in, a lot of them not very well.
Because for some reason, when I'm hearing about that time, I feel angry and I don't know why.
Yeah.
And it's making me angry and wanting you to write, you know, as
and
you are writing.
Should do.
Why do I feel like
there's
why
a, do I there's want... because it's obscene and because it was so unlucky. And I think, you know, yes, it was badly handled and the government didn't do enough, etc., etc. I've got to say, it's kind of a unique situation that a plague comes along and destroys a certain part of the community. I'm not sure any government would have reacted very quickly because it's so strange. I have a hard time criticizing. Goodness knows I'm not defending the Tory government here, but I have a hard time defending them when I know that I spent all those years in the 80s not believing it. I did that. And I'm right in the heart of it. And I'm going, no, not really. Really?
When you're talking about your HIV AIDS story, but then I'm thinking about how you're saying every 6 years someone has to come out on EastEnders. It's like, it's almost the same thing. You know, we had Philadelphia and then the Matthew McConaughey film where he's the gay cowboy. HIV cowboy. But, you know, like, we don't advance with that story, do we?
No.
It's like, same again.
And talk to 18-year-olds and they don't know it all happened. They don't. All those men died. They don't know. So, and that's part of the like the survival mechanism of the human race. Is also, it's like that's what we do, especially with illnesses. We just move on. We don't look back. It's like there's no monument to like the 18 million people who died from the Spanish flu, 40 million in 1918. That was the greatest devastation to the human race. That Spanish flu. People in Antarctica had Spanish flu, and 5% of the world's population was wiped out by that flu. It's absolutely astonishing. We don't talk about it much. You know, someone like Downton Abbey gets a shiver and dies in the year 1918. There we go, nodded towards it. It was an amazing, but that's kind of what we do with illness. What can we do? We survive it, actually. And we ruthlessly move on. And that is hard. You know, what's unusual about AIDS is that we're also a minority and we are also oppressed in all sorts of ways. And, you know, although life gets better. So the illness also fits our problems, weirdly. It fits our cause. Like, oh, you're ignoring us, which actually changes you ignore us in all sorts of ways. So, you know, maybe it militarized us and made us, you know, fight to the... Fascinating thing. It's fascinating.
Really fascinating.
Yes. It sounds fictional, doesn't it? If you wanted a good story, you'd make this up. And an illness comes along that persecutes them but makes them band together and fight for their rights.
The build up to it from the 50s up to what was happening legally through music, what was happening in the clubs. And then the change in how people were, how gay men were, went from sort of gym bunnies to apparently the thing was to not be a gym bunny. So,
really?
Yeah, so people would think that you didn't have AIDS. So then people like Brodsky Beat and how fashion changed and suddenly gay men embraced looking like neo-Nazis, basically. I mean, you know, it was...
But that was liberating. For that, it's like, for Jimmy Tomlin to come along and own jeans like that and shirts like that, that was great appropriation for me. It was like, yeah, you've done on that. We can be as gay as geese and all that sort of stuff. It's a fight, isn't it? It's a proper fight and well fought, I think.
Because of masculinity, that look, is that what you
mean? Yes, that was a very skinhead Nazi look. And that was a very gay man with an extraordinary voice owning it. And just saying, you can't have that. Is that, you know, we'll have anything. Yeah. Not just drag up with dresses, we can drag up in skin.
I think that's what's brilliant about being gay and being an artist. I feel it's a gay man. The subversiveness of being able to do things.
Yeah.
I felt that about you doing Doctor Who. I was like, my God, that's brilliant. Genius. I just think, as a gay man or gay woman, there's such an opportunity to be subversive.
It's bloody
brilliant.
I do find
slightly that, anarchic.
Do you know, I find that, like, in meetings, that I literally find you can be a little bit cheekier than the straight men. It's like, and again, do you know what? That's an echo of that old jester role. You know, the one who's making the jokes, and we're still slightly that. Thank God. Thank God.
My God, I'm going to be intelligent here. But if you look at the jester role in drama over the years, all the way back to Shakespeare,
they're
the soothsayers.
They're the ones telling the truth.
I'm not saying the wise men.
That's the shamans, the tribe. The jester and the shaman are the same thing. They're the ones who tell the truth and puncture the pomposity of the kings and stuff that we rule. I do think so. I think we adopt that role as well. It's like, you know, here we are talking about very serious stuff. We're doing it with each other. Very serious stuff, having a laugh.
I don't know about you, but I'm riding high after that chat. He was such a lovely guy, Russell. I think I told him this, I can't remember. I didn't watch Queer as Folk because I was too scared to watch it. I would get caught.
And also, it was a hit way beyond LGBT people and or only gay men. And I think that's really interesting, shows the merit of his writing. And then taking on Doctor Who, that, you know, taking that on, I mean, my gosh, you know, Doctor Who is like...
Whovians.
Yeah, Whovians. I mean, worse than hooligans. What are they called? Whovians?
Whovians.
Whovians.
Let's call them Whovians.
Oh, come on. I mean, the Whovians or Whovians, they're both weird. Let's be honest. I mean, they are weird. I'm sorry, but they are. I'm going to say it. Call a spade a spade.
He said that,
people
not
that
me.
Become obsessed with Daleks, and they go to conventions, and they dress up, and they put, like, loads of plasticine all over their face, and it's like, what are you doing? And you cover yourself in green. It's like, what are you doing? Grow up, man, for God's sake. They don't exist.
So Will's had half a pint.
This is what happened.
We'd really like to know what you guys thought about that conversation, so please get in touch. Twitter, please get in touch, at Will Young with hashtag Homo Sapiens. Email us, hello@homosapienspodcast.com. May I take this opportunity to say thank you to all our listeners who email all the time. It is so nice to hear from you guys. We read them all.
We read them all, and we use our Homo Sapiens Extra podcast to basically have a chat with you guys.
And please rate and review us in Apple Podcasts. Now, we're told to say Apple Podcasts. It means iTunes.
Yes, iTunes.
And we will choose our review of the week on Homo Sapiens Extra every Friday. And you, not anyone, you could win the exclusive Homo Sapiens t-shirt.
I've worn my Homo Sapiens t-shirt 2 days in a row.
Have you?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's probably the one that's meant for Josh in Putney or whatever.
Back to the tweets that we were talking about earlier. Oh, yes. We asked if you would... only just joined us. I don't know if that's possible on a podcast, but let's just say it anyway.
Just for some unknown reason scrolled halfway through.
Imagine.
You know that this isn't live.
I know this isn't live, but I just want to be Jane Garvey.
No one would let you on the air this drunk.
No, they wouldn't. We were talking about inspirations. Who are your inspirations?
Her Majesty the Queen. Sue Cox said Her Majesty the Queen. Someone said something really interesting about the Queen. Does the Queen continue to be the Queen because she protects her children from what she knows is such a harsh job where you can't have a life?
She'd be my ultimate to interview.
I don't know what I'd say to her.
Like, what do you feed the corgis?
Kirsty Morgan has said Dan B. Harris. So Dan Harris is the guy who wrote a book called 10% Happier, which is about mindfulness. I've read it. He was a real inspiration to me and is why I started doing mindfulness, actually. So right back at you, Kirsty. I agree. Vivian Westwood, says Emma Smith. She is a fucking cool person.
She's, you know, she cycles past my house.
Does she?
Yeah, she cycles up and down that hill. I don't know how old. I mean, she's probably 70-something, no?
Yes.
She's going at it. All guns.
Really?
on a bike that I don't think has many gears. She's very cool. She sticks to her guns, doesn't she? She won't do any interviews unless it's about the environment, and even then, very little.
She is really cool. Lots of people saying their mum.
I thought we'd get a lot of mums.
Mums are great.
I don't think my mum's my inspiration.
Wardrobe-wise, surely.
Okay, let's break it down.
Anyone who rocks a parasol, I'm down with.
Oh, she does, actually. Well, okay, this is what I think about inspirations.
Uh-huh.
Inspiration for me is sort of people that have kind of infiltrated my life, let's say from a teenager, when I'm not looking at my parents. So people are dragging me sort of towards becoming an adult. And those would be shedloads of musicians from 90s R&B pop. They just would.
Yeah.
Genuinely, they would.
Well, it's interesting what you're saying, because I do actually really relate to the idea that it wouldn't be someone close to you. Like, an inspiration is this lightning bolt person from outside your universe who you're like, oh my God, you have shown me a different way or something, you know?
But I don't think I have, like, one inspiration. There's lots of people that I've learnt off. Okay, can I just tell you a story about this person I met, actually? Mm. And it really... And he was... inspiring.
Is he called Chris? Handsome guy. Handsome extraordinary guy. Clothes appeared over the brow of a hill, and I thought,
who can blend mustard and navy blue like that?
Only a genius.
No, it's there is. When I was going up to Manchester last week, I was outside Euston Station, and there was a homeless chap called Harry.
Mm-hmm.
He was like, I'd say 22, 23. And I was really interested in him. And he just had like a real sparkle. And actually not sparkle, he was just intelligent. And I was there with my friend. We got talking. And he'd moved from Blackpool to come down to London because he could get on methadone quicker in London. The waiting list was less time to get off heroin. And I said, you know, why are you homeless? And he said, a mixture of bereavement, mental health and addiction. Mm-hmm. I don't know, I found him really inspiring because you can fall through the cracks, mm-hmm. you know, and once someone's fallen through the cracks in the social system, it's very hard to get back up. Mm-hmm. And he just had this amazing kind of, it wasn't even necessarily that he was like super cheery, there was just something about him. And I found it very sad, but I found him very inspiring, and he was so delightful. And he said, oh, thank you so much for taking the time to actually talk. You know, it's really bolstered me to continue to get better.
Mm.
And, you know, so he was my latest inspiration. Mm. Yeah. Tomorrow it'll probably be Nelly the Dachshund again.
That's it for this week. Thank you.
Okay, you know what? That's it. Game over, Chris Ender.
The dogs are barking in the garden, which leaves just me to say goodbye. That's it for this week. We will be back next week, and we'll be reading out all your messages on Homo Sapiens Extra on Friday. Go on, tell us what you really think. Why don't you get in touch with @WillYoung on Twitter with the hashtag Homo Sapiens, or email us hello@homosapienspodcast.com. See you next week. Will's coming back in time for the jingle. I'll give you a note.
Homo sapiens.
That?
Like a whisper. It's Tracy Chapman.
Oh.
Homo sapiens.
Like a homo.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode, and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Powered by Spirit Studios.